From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Senate holds hearings on John Negroponte's appointment to run the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. Despite his reputation for supporting widespread human rights abuses as ambassador to Honduras in the early 80s, Negroponte's nomination is not being resisted by Democrats or Republicans. We'll speak with three people who knew John Negroponte from his ambassadorship to Honduras. We go to Iraq, where U.S. aircraft and artillery bombarded the Fallujah yesterday in one of the heaviest assaults in the last few days. We'll speak with independent journalist Prothap Chatterjee. Take a look at the unprecedented clash between gunmen and police in the Syrian capital of Damascus. And the Supreme Court hears arguments on a White House effort to keep private the records of Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force, which developed the administration's energy policies in 2001.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this is a case about the separation of powers.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. Overnight, the U.S. unleashed a large air attack on the Iraqi city of Fallujah and sent of the heaviest bombing since the U.S. first attacked the Sunni stronghold 3 weeks ago. AC-130 gunships pounded the city. Shells rocked the city for hours. The number of people killed is unknown, but the Guardian of London reports residents said fighting was worse since a truce was called 2 weeks ago. Al Jazeera aired images of the bombardment around the world. One cleric quoted on the network said the U.S. is targeting ordinary civilians and that they're trying to destroy everything in the city. U.S. officials are saying they're only acting defensively and that it could take 6 to 8 weeks to gain full control of the city. Meanwhile, Spain's pulled out all of its troops from Najaf, and the country's new prime minister said Tuesday all Spanish troops will be out of Iraq by May 27th. 115 U.S. soldiers have now died in combat so far this month. That's the same number killed during the actual invasion of Iraq. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is now estimating 1,200 Iraqis have been killed so far this month. Ted Koppel, host of ABC's Nightline, has announced the program will abandon its typical programming on Friday and dedicate the show to the soldiers killed in Iraq. Koppel plans to spend the entire program simply reading the names of those soldiers killed in combat so far. The United Nations Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, warned against more attacks. He said, quote, "Unless this standoff is brought to a resolution through peaceful means, there's great risk of a very bloody confrontation. The consequences of such bloodshed could be dramatic and long-lasting," he said. Meanwhile, Brahimi met with the Security Council Tuesday and said an Iraqi caretaker government could be named by the end of May, a month ahead of the so-called handover of sovereignty from the United States. The White House is insisting that no recording or transcript be made of the comments by President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney when they meet together with the 9/11 Commission on Thursday morning at the White House, and only one member of the 10-person panel will be allowed to take notes. Bush and Cheney will also be joined by White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez and another lawyer from the counsel's office. The Supreme Court will hear two cases today to determine whether the White House can detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without ever having to press charges or allowing the citizen a chance to appeal his or her detainment in court. The cases involve two U.S. citizens who've been held as enemy combatants, Jose Padilla and Yasser Assam Hamdi. On Tuesday, the High Court appeared to back the Bush administration's assertion that it has executive privilege not to make public notes from an energy task force assembled by Vice President Dick Cheney. We'll be hearing excerpts from the arguments later in the program. In Thailand, police have clashed with a group identified as Islamic militants, leaving 112 people dead. At least 30 died in a raid on a mosque. The incidents took place in southern Thailand near the border with Malaysia. The Los Angeles Times reports Secretary of State Colin Powell met Tuesday with Qatar's foreign minister for intense discussions about the government-funded Al Jazeera satellite TV station. The discussions are expected to last several more days. Powell said on Monday Al Jazeera's news coverage has intruded on relations between the U.S. and Qatar, one of Washington's closest military allies in the Gulf. The Times reports the Pentagon has been systematically monitoring the station and compiling its objection to the reporting, especially to its coverage in Iraq. State Department spokesperson Richard Boucher claimed the issue is not about media freedom. He said Al Jazeera has crossed from reporting to, quote, screaming fire in a crowded theater. During the recent siege in Fallujah, Al Jazeera was the only broadcast outlet inside the city during a time when the U.S. killed up to 600 Iraqis. Their images of dead Iraqis were broadcast throughout the world. A spokesperson from the network said, quote, "We are not involved in politics and try to report what's happening on the ground. We give ample space to various points of view on any issue." Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister traveled to New York on Monday to criticize the U.S. media for demonizing Saudi Arabia, charging that critics of the kingdom are only aiding extremists who want to overthrow the monarch. In a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations, Prince Saud al-Faisal said, quote, "It's ironic that those who most vociferously attack Saudi Arabia are unwittingly serving the purposes of al-Qaeda." The prince cited by name several recent books on Saudi Arabia as problematic, including Craig Unger's House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties, and Robert Baer's Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Its Soul for Saudi Crude. He claimed the criticisms of Saudi Arabia in the books are irresponsibly vicious. And the United Nations has announced the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, Mohammed al-Bardi, will visit Israel later this year, marking his first visit to the country in 6 years. He'll be there to promote nuclear non-proliferation and a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Last week, Israel's nuclear whistleblower, Mordechai Vanunu, called on al-Bardi to come to Israel to inspect Israel's nuclear site at Dimona. Miles Davis here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from New York. Yesterday, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held hearings on President Bush's nominee for U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte. And reports from Capitol Hill indicate he's now on a fast track for Senate confirmation. The vote could come as early as Friday. If confirmed, Negroponte will head up the largest U.S. embassy in the world. With more than 3,000 employees, over 500 CIA officers. Despite what some would call Negroponte's infamous history in Central America, as U.S. ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985, he's come up against almost no congressional opposition, even from Senate Democrats who once criticized him for supporting human rights abuses in Honduras. As ambassador there, Negroponte played a key role in coordinating U.S. covert aid to the Contra death squads in Nicaragua and shoring up a CIA-backed death squad in Honduras. During his term as ambassador in Honduras, diplomats allege the embassy's annual human rights reports made Honduras look more like Norway than Argentina. In a 95 series, the Baltimore Sun detailed the activities of a secret CIA-trained Honduran army unit. known as Battalion 316, that used shock and suffocation devices and interrogations. Prisoners often were kept naked and, when no longer useful, killed and buried in unmarked graves. In 1994, Honduras's National Commission for the Protection of Human Rights reported that it was officially admitted that 179 civilians were still missing. A former official who served under Negroponte says he was ordered to remove all mention of torture and execution from the draft of his 1982 report on human rights in Honduras. During Negroponte's tenure, U.S. military aid to Honduras skyrocketed from $3.9 million to $77 million. Much of this went to ensure the Honduran Army's loyalty in the battle against popular movements throughout Central America. Despite Negroponte's history, Democrats have not offered any organized resistance to his nomination. In fact, some observers describe yesterday's hearing at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as a love fest. Senator Christopher Dodd, who opposed Negroponte when the committee reported his nomination to be ambassador to the United Nations in 2001, has now come out in support of him, saying, quote, "Whatever differences I've had years ago with John Negroponte, I happen to feel he's a fine foreign service officer and has done a tremendous job in many places." Here are some of what Dodd had to say at yesterday's hearing.
In a sense, this is a very non-traditional confirmation hearing. I was trying to recall, Mr. Chairman, of a similar kind of a hearing. We haven't gone quite the extent the Finance Committee did a number of years ago when our former colleague Lloyd Benson was nominated by President Clinton to be Secretary of the Treasury. And as I recall, I think Pat Moynihan actually moved the nomination in the committee, and then they proceeded with the questions. They actually voted him out before they started the questions. We're not going that far, John, here. But in a sense, what I'm getting at here is it's quite obvious that this committee is going to confirm your nomination. And so, in the traditional sense, the normal question-answer period is it not really appropriate here, because I don't think anything you're going to say here is going to dissuade any of us that you shouldn't be the choice and get this job done.
Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd speaking yesterday at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings on John Negroponte. While most Democrats either praise Negroponte or refuse to raise his past record, some of the toughest questioning came from Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. But he didn't question Negroponte on Central America, but rather on Iraq. As Negroponte responded to Hagel, he was interrupted by an activist and filmmaker, Andres Contreras, of the Nonviolence International.
If they have sovereignty, Mr. Ambassador, what does that mean? I mean, do they have sovereignty or don't they have sovereignty on a specific issue like that, which obviously could widen and be applied to any military exercise or national security issue?
And that is why I use the term exercise of sovereignty. I think in the case of military activity, their forces will come under the unified command of the multinational force. That is the plan. And I think that as far as American forces are concerned, coalition forces, I think they're going to have the freedom to act in their self-defense, and they're going to be free to operate in Iraq as they best see fit. But when it comes to issues like Fallujah, as I discussed earlier, I think that that is going to be the kind of situation that is going to have to, in addition to everything else, be the subject of real dialogue between our military commanders, the new Iraqi government, and I think the United States mission as well.
Well,
Ambassador, there can be no dialogue if the United States continues to
explore. Please, let's have order in the hearing. Please, please. Please, let's the ambassador testify. Appreciate the helpfulness of our audience.
There is no sovereignty, Mr. Ambassador. There is no sovereignty if the United States continues to exercise security in Iraq. Senators, please ask the ambassador about Battalion 316.
Please.
Ask him about his involvement in a death squad in Honduras that he supported.
Andres Contreras, Program Director for Latin America and the Caribbean for human rights group Nonviolence International, disrupting the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing on John Negroponte's appointment as U.S. ambassador to Iraq. He joins us on the phone right now. Andres Contreras, it was a little hard to understand what it was that you were saying. What did you say, and why did you feel the need to interrupt this nomination confirmation hearing?
Well, Amy, I felt it was absolutely imperative for those of us who support peace and nonviolence to be at this hearing where this man who we consider to be a state terrorist is about to be confirmed to the largest diplomatic post in U.S. history. What Negroponte was saying at the time is that when it comes to issues like Fallujah, there we need to engage in real dialogue, and I could not believe that he would use such words, and I rose and spoke and said that there can be no dialogue as long as the U.S. continues to commit war on Iraq. I then went on to say that the people of Honduras consider him to be a state terrorist and that we need to be pursuing nonviolence in the Middle East instead of the issue, the way that we are committing violence there with the war. I went on to then emphasize that the senators need to ask the ambassador that about his involvement in human rights violations and particularly his support for a death squad called Battalion 316 while he was ambassador in the early 80s in Honduras.
We're also joined on the phone by Sister Leticia Bordas, who was with us yesterday, Catholic nun with the Society of Helpers, which is a Catholic community of women from San Bruno, California, and Father Joe Mulligan, a Jesuit priest who's been based in Nicaragua for the past 18 years, one of the main people trying to determine what happened to a U.S. priest named James Carney, who has disappeared in Honduras in 1983. You have met with John Negroponte, Father Joe Mulligan. Can you talk about his record as ambassador to Honduras from 81 to 85? Father Joe Mulligan. Father Joe Mulligan?
Yes.
Can you talk about the record of Ambassador Negroponte from 81 to 85?
Well, Ambassador Negroponte was, of course, in charge of U.S. policy in Honduras and also in relation to U.S. policy trying to help to overthrow the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. So he was the main person responsible for that intervention in the sovereign affairs of Nicaragua. And now he's apparently about to be appointed our ambassador to Iraq, where we're seeing a much more drastic, a much more massive and direct intervention in a sovereign country. But also, I think the fact that Mr. Negroponte, when he was ambassador in Honduras, he did not report adequately, nor did the CIA report adequately to Washington on Honduran army violations of human rights. We have this in the CIA Inspector General's report on CIA activities in Honduras in the 80s. Various statements in there, much of the material is blacked out, but there are a number of statements to the effect that the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa during that period of time, and the CIA were downplaying Honduran army violations of human rights in their reports to Washington. This does not augur well for the ability of the American people to know what the United States is doing, will be doing in Iraq, and what the security forces that we are creating will be doing in Iraq.
Can you tell us about what happened to James Carney in Honduras and about this Battalion 316? I'm going to also put the question to Leticia Bordas, who we started a conversation with yesterday. But first, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking about the confirmation of John Negroponte as ambassador to Iraq once the handover takes place. He'll be replacing L. Paul Bremer. Stay with us. La ilaha illallah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Very much looking forward to seeing listeners of WPFW as well as viewers of Baltimore Public Access TV. I think it's Channel 5 tonight in Washington, D.C. as we celebrate community radio, be it UDC Auditorium on Van Ness, University of District of Columbia, in our continuation of the Exception to the Ruler's Tour. You can call WPFW if you want more information. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're talking about John Negroponte to be confirmed as early as Friday as the next ambassador to Iraq, replacing L. Paul Bremer. We're talking to Father Joe Mulligan, a Jesuit priest who'd been based in Nicaragua for the past 18 years, one of the main people trying to determine what happened to Father James Carney, who was a priest who disappeared in Honduras in 1983. You dealt directly with John Negroponte as ambassador to Honduras from 81 to 85.
Well, I talked with Mr. Negroponte at the State Department some years after that, but we talked about the case of Father Jim Carney. During that period of time when he was ambassador, I did not have contact with him, but he told me that he simply accepted the Honduran military's version of what might have happened, which was simply that they didn't know anything about Father Carney. Of course, his body has never been found, but the Honduran military said they didn't know anything about him, but if he was a member of this insurgent group of Hondurans which had come in from Nicaragua, perhaps he had simply starved to death in the mountains. That's been the official position of the Honduran military and government, and Mr. Negroponte said he didn't have any reason to doubt that and that he had not really looked any further into it because he left that up to the Hondurans.
Battalion 316, Sister Leticia Bordas, can you talk about this and why you met with Negroponte as ambassador to Honduras in the early 80s?
Yes, good morning, Amy. As I mentioned yesterday on your program, I had gone to Honduras to meet with then-Ambassador John Negroponte to find out what had happened to 32 women from El Salvador who had taken refuge in Honduras and who disappeared. And at that time, there was the Battalion 316. The Battalion 316 was another name for the horrible death squad that was operating in Honduras at that time. And that was well known to Ambassador Negroponte. The reason I say it was very well known to Ambassador Negroponte was that General Gustavo Alvarez Martinez was then chief of the Honduran Armed Forces, and he was the secret head of Battalion 316. Now, Negroponte and Martinez, the people would tell you, it was known that they would wine and dine together and had ongoing connections. And so it is absurd to think that Mr. Negroponte would say that he did not know what was going on in El Salvador at that time. And as I found out 13 years later, that the women we were looking for had been badly, badly tortured, then put in a helicopter and dropped into the ocean. They used Salvadoran military and helicopters to take these women and drop them over the ocean. Now, Battalion 316 continued to function the whole time that Negroponte was there. And I don't think too many people know that General Gustavo Martinez was kind of, quote, beheaded by his own military. There was kind of a coup. And he took temporary refuge in the United States. And when he went back to Honduras, he was assassinated. And I don't think many people know about that. And it is believed that he was assassinated by members of the military who were very upset with him because of deals that he had made with the United States while he was the general. What angers me very, very much is that there is absolutely no reference being made to the past of Mr. Negroponte in Honduras during these hearings. We just don't hear anything about it. We do not learn from our history. And the people of Iraq are those who are going to be the ongoing victims of John Negroponte, who believes that the end justifies the means.
Father Joe Mulligan, were you surprised that Democrats like Senator Christopher Dodd, who had actually objected to Negroponte's nomination as ambassador to the United Nations, are not raising questions now, in fact, fully supporting him?
Yes, I've been surprised and very disappointed. I mean, I think that his past record is something that needs to be scrutinized. If we're going to have an ambassador in charge of the largest U.S. embassy in the world, we need somebody who does not have a history of, as the CIA Inspector General said, downplaying the human rights situation, downplaying the problem of violations of human rights in that country. I might just add something about Battalion 316. One of the former members of Battalion 316, Florencio Caballero, who deserted from that battalion and left Honduras about in the mid-80s, has testified in a number of instances that Father Jim Carney was captured by the Honduran army and turned over for interrogation and torture and elimination by Battalion 316. So we have different kinds of reports about the fate of Father Carney, and as I said earlier, Mr. Negroponte has simply accepted the official statement of the Honduran military that perhaps Father Carney, an American citizen, starved to death in the mountains. There was also another American citizen in that group. It was a small group of Honduran insurgents who entered Honduras from Nicaragua. Father Carney went along as a chaplain accompanying the group, but there was another U.S. citizen, a Nicaraguan-American in that group, David Baez, who, interestingly enough, had been a member of the U.S. Green Berets for about 11 years previously and then had returned to his native country, Nicaragua, and then joined this group of about 100 Hondurans, along with Father Carney, going into Honduras. And David Baez, another U.S. citizen, also disappeared. We've never been able to find his remains, nor have we been able to find out exactly what happened. But I think the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador in a particular country, is responsible to investigate what happened in the case of the disappearance of two American citizens. And Mr. Negroponte simply accepted the official Honduran line on that. And as I said, the embassy and the CIA were underestimating or underreporting the violations of human rights in Honduras in their reports to Washington.
Well, Father Joe Mulligan, I want to thank you for being with us. I should also add that Father Mulligan has just come out of jail, serving 3 months for protesting at School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. Sister Leticia Bordas, a Catholic nun with the Society of Helpers, thank you. And Andres Canteras with the group Nonviolence International and one of the filmmakers who did Hidden in Plain Sight about the School of the Americas. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to Iraq, U.S. aircraft artillery bombarded the Iraqi town of Fallujah yesterday, one of the heaviest assaults in the last few days. In an intensive use of firepower by U.S. forces, artillery barrages were accompanied by the deployment of a heavily armed AC-130 gunship. U.S. commanders besieging the town said the assault was in response to several breaches of the local ceasefire. Two Tuesday night's bombardment was shown live on television networks around the world, including Al Jazeera, which is seen widely in Iraq and throughout the Arab world. No word yet on casualties in the town, which lies 30 miles west of Baghdad. Guerrillas in Fallujah didn't turn in their heavy weapons by yesterday's deadline, but the U.S. says it still doesn't plan on a full-scale attack. Second time in 2 days, they used the AC-130, a converted cargo plane nicknamed Spooky or Spectre, which spews concentrated cannon and machine gun fire over the ground. U.S. officers said an AC-130 killed some 64 Shia militiamen loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr at Kufa near the holy city of Najaf in southern Iraq. A spokesperson for Sadr told the London Guardian, quote, "The Americans are agitating the situation. Sadr demands that the occupation should end all over Iraq. The Americans hate him because he refuses to bargain with them." We go right to Fallujah, to Scott Peterson. He is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, joining us on the phone where he's been embedded with U.S. troops for the last several days. Welcome to Democracy Now, Scott.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what is happening in Fallujah from your vantage point embedded with the troops, U.S. troops?
Well, at the moment, in the past hour or so, there has been another, there have been many more explosions that have been taking place in the southwest of the city this time, as opposed to the northwest, which is what we saw overnight. We've had these Spectre gunships that you described in your report flying overhead as I speak. In fact, they're flying, and they've been around for more than an hour and a half. They fly very high. They're very effective. We've seen them in many different theaters. It's not clear yet what their target has been in this case, although last night they were specifically going after two trucks that had been identified as being full of weaponry, and they also, after blowing both of those up, which caused a lot of secondary explosions, they then struck a house next door to where those trucks were, which also proved to have been a weapons depot, and that also caused quite a few of the fireworks that we saw last night.
What about people saying that it's not that it is different what's happening in Fallujah right now, it's just that Al Jazeera is broadcasting the images to the world, which is calling attention to it?
Well, no, I think it's not just Al Jazeera. I think the fact that there was this, I mean, Al Jazeera is only picking up the CNN pool camera, which happens to be there and happened to be filming that last night. CNN ran with that live for more than an hour and a half, I understand, last night, and because it was a pool camera, it was picked up by television stations around the world. So I think everybody saw what it was. It looked like, and I heard this from a lot of people who were interviewing me at the time, it looked like perhaps the Marines had actually launched their offensive on Fallujah, there were no indications of that during the day. And indeed, it turns out that it seems that there was a window of opportunity that was taken by the Marines when they spotted these vehicles. They've apparently been trying to get those hit this location, and were suspecting it for quite some time.
Scott Peterson, what is it like to be embedded with the troops? What about your perspective there, as opposed to your independent reporting outside of that in the past?
Well, at the moment, it's not possible for a Western correspondent, anyway, to report independently from Fallujah, simply because it is too dangerous. Of course, you are aware of the hostage situation that has been occurring over recent weeks in Iraq, so that has made it that has limited our movements anyway. In terms of working with the Marines, in this case, at the moment, I'm on a base several miles east of Fallujah itself, but I will be in the next day or two heading out to a battalion, one of the units that is right on the cordon around the city. And there are several journalists that are in such locations. And in fact, that's where the camera footage came that we all saw last night. But at the moment, however, there's very little contact that I have or any journalist have really with Iraqis who are in Fallujah. Anyone who is with the Marines is, you know, they are also not in very close contact with too many Iraqis.
And what are the Marines saying?
Well, they are their morale. I mean, they've taken a lot of hits in the last month. I mean, this has been the most bloody month for U.S. forces in their history in Iraq. That's including the first Gulf War plus the invasion last year. So they have they've taken a lot of casualties. Most of those were in Fallujah during the last month. And so I think that they're they say that they are eager to do whatever they are ordered to do, and they're more than willing to roll into the city. But I think the top brass and the command here have made it very clear to us that that is not their first option, and they are exercising other options that they are hoping will lead to a more peaceful solution.
Is there concern about the Iraqi civilian population in Fallujah?
Well, last week the U.S. Marine commanding general said that he might demand that non-combatants leave the city as a prelude to an actual Marine assault. At the moment, that assault does not look imminent, and we are hearing lots of voices suggesting that it may not happen, at least not for a while. I think the Marines are very aware that there are lots, tens of thousands, perhaps as many as 200,000 or more civilians in the city at the moment, and that this is a very serious obstacle to any military solution that they might try to attempt. So I think that they're aware of that. It's one of the reasons why they're pursuing this, you know, this kind of so-called diplomatic route at the moment. And they're aware also, and that awareness is probably growing, about the political and military ramifications of moving into Fallujah and taking control, but really not carrying any Iraqis with them.
Scott Peterson of the Christian Science Monitor in Fallujah, embedded with the U.S. Marines, and our studio, Prathap Chatterjee, who has just returned from Iraq. He is a managing director of CorpWatch.org, an independent reporter, one of the few who got into Fallujah. Your perspective talking to Iraqis there, Prathap, as you listen to Scott Peterson embedded with the Marines.
Actually, it was my cameraman who went in. I was meeting with a lot of the people who are coming out of Fallujah, and they were brought, for example, by ambulance, by NGOs, to the hospitals in Baghdad, where the U.S. Army then invaded the hospitals, took down their names, and arrested people in the hospitals in complete flouting of the Geneva Convention. So there is possibilities to get in, but you need to travel with the local people, and people are doing that. NGOs are doing that. None of the journalists, the military, in fact, for the first time in 6 months, I'm on there, a lot of their listservs, is asking people to embed because they're not getting enough. They're not getting enough people to embed with the troops. And so it is possible, if you travel with the local people, to have a perspective there. And I think the footage that I've been seeing and the voices that I've been hearing, the news that I'm watching today, I think is really not showing the other side of the fact that the Marines shoot. The moment they declare a ceasefire, the moment somebody steps out in the street, they start shooting. So, one of the things that my cameraman witnessed, for example, was the fact that when they were traveling in an ambulance, a clearly marked ambulance, it says in English, ambulance, with a blue siren going, the Marines shot into the vehicle through the windshield at the driver. And you can see, if you look at the footage, you can actually see the hole in the windshield above the driver's face. And they shot the wheels out, they shot the engine out. So there's a lot of provocation in part of the military. The idea that there's no siege, I mean, that's what's happening. That's what happened last night. I mean, the pounding of the city. These images, these people coming back to the hospitals, as they arrive, people are spiriting them away into the city because they're now afraid of the military following them in each place. And each place, the military is shutting down hospitals. When I was at the Karama Hospital in Baghdad, I met a doctor who'd been sent from Najaf. They shut down the main hospital in Najaf. This is a story that is not made into anywhere in the news media, that every major place that the military has attacked, they've shut down the hospitals. And the problem from the point of view of somebody who's embedded with the military is there's no way, as Scott Peterson said, to know what's actually happening on the other side. The fact that people cannot get to any kind of medical aid. So this is the problem. And what's happening meanwhile is the journalist, there was a CNN journalist who is going to go to Fallujah independently 2 weeks after the offensive started. And once they got half an hour outside of their hotel, their heavily guarded hotel, they saw a burnt military convoy, and they skedaddled and came right back. And we burst out laughing because that particular convoy was burnt 2 weeks ago. But they were completely afraid of going inside. And so Scott Peterson's right in a sense. None of the Western media outside of Al Jazeera is actually going inside and sees. I mean, the kind of footage that we took in Fallujah shows that person after person that's coming into the clinics, and these are makeshift clinics that have been set up, are women and children. And that's what people understand and feel and hear on the ground throughout Iraq. So the imagination of the military is that there's a fixed number of insurgents or terrorists or whatever that they can kill. What they don't understand is that every day, as they kill somebody, they're actually creating two more people angry. I mean, you have to go to the Friday prayers in the Shia mosques and the Sunni mosques to see people coming together. In, you know, the Omel Kora Mosque, which is the most the biggest Sunni mosque in Baghdad, you can see you know, people shouting, Ash, Ash, Muqtada. Now, Muqtada happens to be, you know, a fairly marginal, not very well-respected cleric in the Shia community. The fact that, thousands of people among the Sunni are calling to support him, the fact that every mosque is full to overflowing with bags of food, that, you know, there was this woman who came in with the last food she had in 4,000 dinars, $3, dragging down the street because she couldn't lift it. People are just pouring aid into Fallujah. They support it. They see it across the country as a symbol of resistance.
Prathap Chatterjee, independent reporter just back from Iraq, managing director of CorpWatch.org. We'll be back with him in a minute. Then we're going to look at what's happened in Syria, the explosions yesterday, and finally the Supreme Court case around whether Vice President Dick Cheney will continue to be able to keep the list of advisors who help shape U.S. energy policy secrets. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at what's happening in the Middle East, our guest in the studio is Prathap Chatterjee, just back from Iraq. We also want to look at what's happening in Syria, and we're going to go there for just a minute. At least four people killed yesterday in an unprecedented clash between Syrian police and a team of bombers in the Syrian capital of Damascus. Gunmen attacked a former UN office in a diplomatic quarter of Damascus, setting off a battle with police that pelted nearby buildings with bullets and grenade. The Syrian government said two of the attackers, a policeman and a civilian, were killed in the fighting. Syrian officials are implying Islamic militants were responsible for the attack, and state TV has shown video of weapons, including rocket-propelled grenades, it said were from a cache used by the bombers. Violence is almost unheard of in Syria, where the ruling Ba'ath Party tightly controls any dissent. In 1982, over 20 years ago, the Muslim Brotherhood staged rebellion in the northern province of Hama. During the clashes, Syrian forces razed much of the city, killing as many as 10,000 people, crushing the Brotherhood after a five-year war. Last month, Syria, about 30 people were killed in clashes between Syrian Kurds and police after a soccer match brawl in the northern town of Qamishli escalated. We go now to Patrick Seal, who's a British journalist, covered Middle East for 30 years, specializing in Syria. His biography is called Assad, the struggle for the Middle East, about the former Syrian leader. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrick Seal.
Thank you very much.
Your response to what happened in Syria, did it surprise you yesterday, these explosions?
Well, it did rather surprise me, in that Syria had so far been spared from the sort of attacks which Turkey suffered from, of course, in Saudi Arabia, and indeed the recent scare in Jordan, just next door. So Syria had somehow managed to protect itself from attacks by Islamic militants, partly, it is supposed, it is alleged, because of the nationalist stance which the Syrian government has adopted, and the fact that, after all, it does support Islamic militant groups abroad, like Hezbollah and Hamas. So, but nevertheless, that period of indemnity, as it were, of immunity, has come to an end, or appears to have come to an end.
What exactly now does this mean? Do you think we're going to get any information further about what has happened?
Well, that is the point. The Syrians are not terribly good at communicating exactly what's happening. They have a policy of fairly strict censorship of news. And so those of us outside the country are still not clear about the scale of the events that took place last night. I mean, eyewitnesses spoke of 14 or 15 explosions in different parts of the city. So it sounds as if it may have been a little bit bigger than the report from the official report that only there was one car containing four or five militants and that two were killed and two were captured. So the truth of the matter is that the whole picture has not yet come out. It is curious, of course, that they should have attacked a former UN office building, which was then empty. Admittedly, it's in the same region as the residence of the British ambassador. There were also Iranian and Saudi buildings fairly close. But it's not clear who the attackers were. It's not clear exactly what their targets were. It's not clear whether they were able to reach any of these targets. It's not clear whether this arms cache was discovered before or after these events, whether this was a failed attempt at something bigger, or whether in fact it was something bigger, which has since been covered up.
Patrick Seale, I want to thank you for being with us, British journalist covering the Middle East for some 30 years. He has written the biography of the former leader of Syria called Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. This is Democracy Now! As we return to Iraq with Prothap Chatterjee, who's just returned from there. I want to go to a clip that Prothap Chatterjee has brought back.
احنا نقول لهم تريد تعيشون بسلام ونعيش بسلام انطونا رواتب ما تريد تعيشون بسلام لا تعطونا رواتب
if you want to live in peace Americans so give us our salary for living if you do not so every time we go there we come here and you know with next time with weapons
يا شباب احنا بس دعايه وحكي خوش يدعي بالحريه اسمع حرية وديمقراطية وحرية الشعب العراقي واحترام الشعب العراقي زين وانا احترام الشعب العراقي وانا حقوق الانسان هو يدعي حقوق الانسان
وينها told us and speaks about human rights and respect so where is it where are promises you talk about human rights where are they
And that is scenes from a street in Baghdad, recorded by Prothap Chatterjee, who is managing director of CorpWatch.org, an independent reporter. Give us the context of this scene.
These are workers right outside the Baghdad Convention Center, where the main military and outside the Al Rashid Hotel, the Green Zone. And so they're saying, we haven't been paid in months. We haven't been paid our back wages. You know, where are our jobs? Where are our human rights? And if we don't get paid, we're going to come back and kill people. The interesting thing is these contractors, most of Iraq is now run by companies, and especially the security, a lot of the security, well, the scenes we've seen from Fallujah, the reason for this military offensive is the killing of these military contractors who are paid up to $1,000 a day, Blackwater and people like that. Now, these people, a luxurious salary for an Iraqi is $20 a day. You could hire 50 Iraqis for the price that you're paying for each of these security people. The reason those people were attacked in Fallujah was because they were seen as CIA. They were coming through town wearing their Oakley sunglasses, you know, driving these armored vehicles, you know, with guns blazing. And what's happening today in this escalation is these companies are now banding together, Blackwater, DynCorp, people like that, and creating their own private army, which is bigger than the British force. So this is something that was reported, in the Washington Post and people like that, that on the one hand, people talk about the sort of ragtag army of the Mahdi. They also forget that there's ragtag mercenary armies cobbled together from, apartheid era people from South Africa, Pinochet's regime, who are being brought now to Iraq and being cobbled together in an army that is, going out and shooting people. And this is what we're paying for with our taxpayer dollars. And so really, what's happening is this is a government by private contractors on behalf of the U.S. government, and we're paying for it with our taxes.
And when you say paying for it with the taxes, because it's the U.S. government who's paying for these mercenary forces there?
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, every contractor that is, let's say, rebuilding the electricity system, such as Bechtel or companies like Halliburton that are, you know, transporting food, their bills get paid for by the American military. And therefore, the bills are sent to us and we pay whatever it is. And some of these people, there's a company called Science Applications International Corporation in San Diego that was, you know, the company that hired 150 Iraqi Americans to go run the country. And this company had another contract to run something called the Iraqi Media Network, were given a budget of $15 million. By the end of the year, they'd spent $82 million. Like these workers, at the same time that those people were protesting outside, inside the Green Zone, their workers protested three times for not being paid, while the executives were flying in armored Humvees from outside the country in chartered jets. So this is the absurdity of the equation. People, companies from America, truck drivers from Texas being paid $8,000 a month, people flying in armored Humvees, and they're not even paying their local workers. And this is why there's so much resentment. People realize there's money. They realize that, you know, the contractors are making... They don't see them as Blackwater and DynCorp. They see them as CIA. And so every attack, every group that comes through Iraq with all this money builds resentment among the 3 out of 4 Iraqis who have no jobs.
Pratap Chatterjee, your cameraman, David Martinez, was kidnapped. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, David was on his second trip to Fallujah about 2 weeks ago. And when he went there, he was there partly to do a humanitarian work, which is to travel in an ambulance and to try and bring out dead bodies. And local people were trapped in the houses. The Marines wouldn't leave. He was not able to do that because the Marines continuously fired on them. So he had to return. And on his way back out of Fallujah, the Marines blocked his departure. And so we're talking about, you know, 3 white Americans and British people speaking English who were banned from leaving Fallujah by the Marines. So they had to return. And at that point, they were seen as coming from the Marines, and they were captured by the resistance, the Mujahideen over there. And they were taken for a day. They were treated very well. And once the people who had captured them realized that they were not part of the American military force, they drove them to Baghdad, at which point they were able to, with the help of David and his companions, Joe, were able to get people past the Marine checkpoints. The Marines wouldn't let people out of Fallujah, women and children, because they had a man driving the car. A lot of these women don't know how to drive, and the Marines were like, sorry, there's a man in the car. If you're male and if you're under the age of 70, you need to stay in the city. The whole idea that civilians need to leave the city is completely untrue. It's only women and children on foot who can leave. Everybody else has to stay there. If they leave their houses, they're fired upon. I mean, this is, you know, the massacre, the Holocaust that we're seeing in Fallujah. It is not, you know, a reaction to insurgents. It's simply punishment for the killing of these mercenaries.
Pratap Chatterjee, I want to thank you for being with us, and I'm very thankful you came back safe. Pratap Chatterjee of CorpWatch.org. As we move now to our last segment, Supreme Court heard long-awaited arguments yesterday in a White House effort to keep private the records of Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. 3 years ago, the group's Judicial Watch and the Sierra Club sued for the right to make public the notes of the group's meetings, but the Bush administration's refused to, despite orders from lower federal judges. The groups contend Cheney's task force was not a purely governmental body, but took heavy input from energy industry lobbyists who are deeply involved in formulating federal policy and therefore must disclose its deliberations. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman writes, quote, Cheney's determination to keep his secrets probably reflects more than an effort to avoid bad publicity. It's also a matter of principle, based on the administration's deep belief that it has the right to act as it pleases and that the public has no right to know what it's doing. Krugman continues, quote, Mr. Cheney is defending, in other words, is a doctrine that makes the United States a sort of elected dictatorship, a system in which the president, once in office, can do whatever he likes and isn't obliged to consult or inform either Congress or the public. Let's take a listen to how the arguments began at the Supreme Court yesterday.
We'll hear argument now number 03-472-475, Richard B. Cheney versus United States District Court. General Olson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is a case about the separation of powers. The Constitution explicitly commits to the President's discretion the authority to obtain the opinions of subordinates and to formulate recommendations for legislation. Congress may neither intrude on the President's ability to perform these functions nor authorize private litigants to use the courts to do so. As this court has construed the Federal Advisory Committee Act to to avoid what the court regarded and described as formidable constitutional questions. FACA does not permit the litigation and discovery the respondents wish to pursue.
That was Solicitor General Ted Olson addressing the Supreme Court. Later in the proceedings, the attorney for Judicial Watch explained the merits of the case. He is questioned by Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens.
There's been a couple of statements with respect to our complaint being based on nothing more than mere unsupported allegations. That is a false statement in our view. In order to support our claims, we are relying first and foremost on the statement in the memorandum creating the document that says the Vice President has discretion to create subordinate working groups. Then we also attach several statements, acknowledgments by the government that described meetings between task force representatives and representatives Enron and representatives of other working groups. I believe the government itself acknowledged there were at least five such meetings. We know that the Vice President met with the chairman of Enron, Ken Lay. The Vice President himself, in an interview he gave on Nightline, said, we met with all kinds of folks. We met with energy groups. We met with environmental groups. We met with
what does
groups.
That prove? I don't see how that's...
What does that prove?
The point is that this shows the involvement of outside...
They talked to a lot of people, got a lot of advice, but that does that make them de facto members of the committee?
Well, that's the question that we're seeking to answer through our discovery. The point is that this is not an unsupported, these are not mere unsupported allegations.
Well, I'm not sure that's right. Just because you said they talked to a lot of people doesn't really prove anything, it doesn't seem to me.
Well, if you put that together, the allegations of the individuals that were met with the statement in the memorandum that allows the Vice President discretion to create working groups, we think it does at least raise a significant question as to whether outside individuals were participating in these working groups and participating in the committee as a whole.
That was Judicial Watch attorney Paul Orfanides being questioned by Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. We're joined on the phone by Tom Fitton, who is the president of Judicial Watch, one of the two plaintiffs in the lawsuit, along with the Sierra Club. In a very quick summary, why you feel it's so important that the information is released, who the vice president consulted with.
Well, requires it, and this administration, like other administrations, need to comply and be held accountable to the law, however politically uncomfortable it is. The Federal Advisory Committee Act, which is the Open Meetings Law, is designed to ensure that these special task force, these special commissions, when they use outsiders, that the information about its deliberations be made public, and that the groups themselves, the task force in this case, get views from both sides of the aisle, both sides of the issue, really. And because what the president's asking us to do is say, this is not me talking. He's saying this is the energy task force. You got to pay special attention to it. And if he's asking for us to give it that added credibility, then we have a right under the law to find out more about its operation, specifically if he had outsiders involved in a way that would, that A, violated the law, and B, you know, cast a doubt upon the recommendations as being sophisticated or well thought out.
Tom Fitton, I want to thank you for being with us, President of Judicial Watch, and that does it for today's program. You can go to our website, get contact information. The website is democracynow.org. Our producers are Sharif Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, and Nagara Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! On to Washington tonight at UDC Auditorium, Van Ness.